That's a portion of the song entitled Spirit Says to Sing Your Song. It's from the CD entitled I Walk in the Love of God. That's our Agape International Choir. The song was penned by Dr. Ricky and myself. And it's from that powerful CD, I Walk in the Love of God. Spirit Says to Sing Your Song, and that's so absolutely true. I have with me Michael Neal. He's an internationally renowned transformational coach and the best-selling author of Inside Out Revolution and the Space Within. His most recent release will be due out in January, January 2nd, just in time for you guys to embrace your intentions for the year. It's called Creating the Impossible, a 90-day program to get your dreams out of your head and into the world. Michael is also the creator of the popular Obstacle Course to Success and coaching from the Inside Out self-study programs. His books and audio programs teach us how to tap into the deeper intelligence behind life, to access our natural wisdom and guidance, and to unleash our limitless creative power, allowing us to live with less stress, greater ease, and a sense of connection to the larger unfolding of life. They are essential guides to helping ourselves and assisting others. He has spent over 25 years as a coach, advisor, friend, mentor, and creative spark plug to celebrities, CEOs, royalty, and people who want to get more out of themselves and their lives. His books have been translated into 17 languages, and his public talks, retreats, and seminars have touched and transformed lives at the United Nations and on six continents around the world. Michael's weekly radio show, Living from the Inside Out, has been a listener favorite on Hay House Radio for over a decade. His TED Talk, Why Aren't We Awesomer?, has been viewed by over 170,000 people around the world. You can follow him, of course, on his Twitter and Facebook and get access to his Caffeine for the Soul podcast and blog at michaelneal.org, michaelneill.org. Michael, welcome back to the show. Welcome back to Wake Up, the Sound of Transformation, man.
Thank you, Michael. I forgot how much fun it is to be played in by gospel singers. I need to have them walk around with me. I want to have that everywhere I go.
Right. You got to have a little soul soundtrack.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it'll make riding the bus nicer, if nothing else.
Absolutely. To activate that energy. Well, I'm looking forward to talking with you about your wonderful book that's upcoming. I mean, you have some great books that you've already put out there, but Creating the Impossible, a 90-day program to get your dreams out of your head and into the world. It's obviously released January 2nd, in time for those folks who are starting their embracing New Year's resolutions. And it's profoundly insightful, practical, to birthing any dream that we desire. You know, you carry it, the vibration in it, and whether it's starting a new business, paying off debt, losing weight, traveling the world, writing a book, becoming a leader in your field. You know, even meeting your soulmate, you know, you're embracing what some people would call the impossible, but you break it down so people could actually leap into that with beautiful results in their life. So share with us the premise behind your book.
It started because I've been working with clients for, I mean, it's coming up on 30 years now. And one of the things I noticed that was consistent is there were sort of two approaches to creating. And the most common one was people would go for what they thought they could get.
Right.
And maybe they'd stretch a little. So, you know, what they thought they could get plus 10%. You know, so if I've got a decent job, I want a slightly better job. If I've got, you know, a certain amount of money, I want a little bit more money. And it was always because there was no deeper call in it.
Right.
Because there was no real connection to an authentic desire. Yeah, if you work hard, you can do a lot of stuff. But then there were other people who had what seemed to be like an inspired calling, who were drawn to things that didn't look possible, didn't look plausible. Hard work enough wasn't going to get you there, and yet they still were able to create it in their lives and in the world. And I got fascinated by that. And at a certain point, when I sort of saw that there were kind of spiritual principles underpinning the whole thing, it all made sense to me, and I was able to start teaching people the difference and how to take advantage of the sort of deeper creative potential we all have inside us.
I like this idea of the impossible dream because it helps us break out of, as you were saying, our narrow paradigm. People have a tendency, as you said, to go for what we think we can get. But if you embrace what the mind would call impossible, then it begins to activate things within you. You don't even know we're there.
It not only activates things within you that you don't know were there, but things start showing up in the world around you that you didn't see when you started.
Right. The possibilities, opportunities, things that are there, but they're invisible to you because you're operating from a lower viewpoint, so to speak.
And it's interesting because most people take sideline and think, oh, I couldn't do that. There's no point. That's never going to happen. Not realizing that the view from the field, that when you're actually in the game, it's a completely different view.
Mm-hmm.
And so things that looked impossible from the sideline, and everyone would agree with you, were impossible. Actually, all you're ever doing is taking the next step.
Right.
And the next step is always in front of you.
Right. Now, you offer what I think are three great pointers to help readers get the most out of your book. You talk about read it for insight, not information. Look for principles, not strategies. And be an explorer, not a researcher. Break that down for us.
Well, insight, not information. I share the story. You know, we both live in L.A., and so earthquakes are part of most people's history or probably our future. And I met a guy who left L.A. after the Northridge earthquake and moved to the Bronx in New York. And he told me that his first night in New York City, he wakes up at 6 in the morning, and it's an earthquake. And he freaks out. He goes and runs and finds a doorway. And then at 6:15, there's an aftershock. 6:30, there's an aftershock. And at 6:45, there's an aftershock. And then he gets suspicious, and he's like, wait a minute. They don't have earthquakes in New York. And he realizes it's the subway. He's just running under his... And he feels the building shake. Now, once he got that insight, the train kept coming, but he had no fear.
Right.
Until he had that insight, you could tell him there were no earthquakes in New York City, and he would go, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm having earthquakes every 15 minutes. So when we look towards a spiritual truth, when we look towards a truth about life, more information just clogs the channels, but insight is priceless because
yes.
It clears the channels.
Yes, I love insight. I always define insight as an event that happens in consciousness in which we come to know something that we either previously believed or had information about. I always like the word insight because it's like a timeless truth hits our awareness and suddenly we're extemporal, we're out of time, we know something now. Like your friend did.
I love that definition because, to my mind, truth is uncovered, not discovered.
Absolutely.
It's already there.
It's already there.
We just don't see it till we see it.
Right. And then you teach, look for principles, not strategies.
Well, so the problem with strategies is it's almost like physics versus engineering. If you have bad physics, the best engineering is not going to save your bridge.
Right.
So principles are things that are unchanging, that are true, that are reliable, that will always be true, that are as true for good men as bad. They were as true 1,000 years ago as they will be 1,000 years from now. Strategies sometimes apply in certain situations for some people, kind of. And so if you can find a timeless principle and learn to operate in harmony with those timeless principles, you'll do great no matter what the project. Some strategies will work for some things, for some people, some of the time.
Right.
And so I'm always pointing people upstream towards the principles and away from the strategies, because if you try to copy someone else's strategy, it probably won't work the same for you, because you're not them, you're not in the same situation as them, the world isn't the same as it was when they did what they did, and you wind up thinking you're a failure because their strategy didn't work for you.
Right, conditions have
shifted. Whereas a principle's a principle. Like gravity is a principle. Gravity worked the same, as best I can tell, for Hitler as for Gandhi.
Right.
It's just a thing.
Right.
And when you start to see there are actually principles behind how the mind works, behind how our experience is created, behind how things get created in the world, well, then you're ready to take on the world. Now you've got something that you can rely on. Now you've got solid ground from which to explore.
Absolutely. And then you segue right into being an explorer and not a researcher.
Well, and that's the thing, is one of the things that I've learned over the years, it used to puzzle me how I could have 100 students come on a program and 30 of them, their lives would change, and 70 of them would have a nice time.
Mm-hmm.
And what I started to see over time was that the ones who were just having a nice time were researchers. They were there to collect data that they might use at a future point to try and do something.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones who were impacted were the explorers. They were there not to learn, you know, to gather more information, to do, I sometimes talk about it as exam prep.
Right.
Test prep, right? Some people come on a course or read a book as test prep. They want to get all the right answers, so if somebody asks them, they can give the right answer.
Right.
But an explorer is just out there to have an experience and see what they can see for themselves. Right? Reading a book about the forest canopy in Costa Rica is not the same as walking the forest canopy in Costa Rica.
Absolutely. The map
and
is
so
the territory.
You really want to get what's on offer from your work, from my work, from anyone who teaches spiritual truth. You got to be an explorer. Researching is just, it's going to make you sound really impressive over coffee.
Right. You become like a metaphysical intellectual rather than an actual.
Yeah, you become a philosopher, not a theosopher. You're speaking from learned knowledge, not from direct experience.
Right. And going in with the idea being I'm exploring something, you're on an adventure of expanded awareness. You're available to insight. You're available to transformation. You're available to change. And so you're really exploring so that you're a different person during the exploration. It's not just, as you're saying, gathering information to memorize. You're actually having an encounter. It's not Memorex. It's like the real deal.
You know, there's a T.S. Eliot poem I love that begins, "We shall not cease from exploration. And the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time."
For the very first time. And that's how we want to live, with the people we know, the things we have to do to live in that particular space. So it's always a moment by moment insight and revelation.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Creating the Impossible, the book came from an online program I've run since 2009, and the online program is subtitled A 90-Day Adventure. That's
yes.
Exactly the spirit of it.
I speak about adventure a lot myself, because when you go on an adventure, you don't know what's going to happen. You know, you may go on a path that you've never walked on before, so you have heightened awareness. And in that heightened awareness, you're able to catch guidance and wisdom and inspiration. And at the end of that particular adventure, you're actually transformed. But if you're just moving through life with a small, narrow point of view, seeking just to protect yourself against bad things, you don't change. You're the same person. You have a linear way of living. But I've always loved that word adventure. You know, that's why at the beginning of the program, I have the song, "We're Taking an Adventure in Paradise," you see.
Well, the beautiful thing about adventure is you can't fail on an adventure.
Right.
Right? It's like you had an adventure or you didn't.
Right.
If you go down a path that doesn't lead anywhere, that's not, oh, I failed. It's like, wow, that was part of the adventure.
Right. And you discovered
something. You don't get downhearted. You don't get discouraged as easily. And consequently, you stay in the adventure longer. And so much of the secret to success is continuing to show up after the point where other people stop.
Oh, yeah. I want you to talk about that. If you're just tuning in to Wake Up the Sound of Transformation, I'm with Michael Neal, internationally renowned transformational coach, best-selling author of Inside Out Revolution in the Space Within, and coming out beginning of January, his latest contribution, Creating the Impossible, a 90-day program to get your dreams out of your head and into the world. And so, Michael, you talk about the fact that when it comes to creating the impossible, there are three ways that we can fail to bring our dreams to life. What are those?
Well, they sound almost too mundane to be relevant, but actually, to my mind, they're really important to see. There's only three ways you're ever going to fail. One is you never start.
Absolutely.
That's the most common one.
That's the sideline.
Talk yourself a bit before you ever get into the game. And that's one of the reasons that I call the program Creating the Impossible. You know, my own wife, when I first told her I wanted to create a program like that, she said, well, why would I go for anything if I didn't know that I was going to be able to do it? And I was like, well, that's the whole point. You think you know, but we're terrible at predicting the future.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the first reason, and the main reason, like the number one dream killer, is you don't start.
Right, right.
The number two is you give up before you get there.
Ah.
And you usually give up before you get there because you get so discouraged, you get so downhearted that continuing on feels futile and pointless and hopeless. And a lot of what I talk about in the book is an understanding of where our experience comes from, where our feelings come from, where discouragement comes from, where hope comes from, such that you can try all sorts of things without getting downhearted, without taking your wrong turns to heart.
Right.
And then the third reason is you run out of time. But that happens a lot less often than people think. Usually what that means is I made up a time frame,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't create what I wanted within that time frame. Every now and again, there's an external time frame. I always think of this as an older, you referenced Memorex, that was 80s. I'm going
right.
to go back to the 50s. There was a quarterback who played for the Detroit Lions, Bobby Lane. And they used to say about him, he never lost a football game. He just sometimes ran out of time.
Ah, that's great. That's great. I use that kind of metaphor as well. I'm just talking about sports in general, how we create a fictitious length of time to play a game. But eventually, it would all shift back and forth depending on the talents on the team. Yeah, we just ran out of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of the 90-day game. Right, I create it as a game. I put a time frame on it because it makes it easier to pay attention. If you build a playing field, it's easier to play the game. But the truth is, a surprising number of people who played this game do wind up creating what they really wanted to create, but just not in the 90 days.
Right. In other words, you're combining one, adventure, two, playing a game, and then three, you're helping them develop habits so that even after the 90 days, they still have a way of moving through the world that's going to bring about more happiness and more success anyway.
And my favorite thing is when somebody comes out of the program and they write me later and they tell me, you know, the biggest thing I got from this program is now when something occurs to me or someone asks me to do something and my first thought is, well, that's impossible. My second thought is, let's do it.
Let's do it. Right. I love it. I love it. Now, we're entering into the creative process to a degree. We're starting to talk about it. Help us to understand going from the feeling, the creative spark within us, to actually holding something in our hands or seeing something manifest in our life. How do you describe that creative process?
Well, there are some very predictable phases that all creative projects go through, whether you're creating a piece of art or you're creating a beautiful relationship or you're creating your church or you're creating a business that you love that contributes to the world. It's the same stages, the same phases, and it begins with nothing. Everything comes from nothing.
That's right.
And the beauty of that is it means you've already got to start.
Right.
I don't care how little you got nothing.
Right.
And so you're already there. And when people see that, it's comforting because it stops feeling like, well, I can't go for this until. I can't be about this until I've got this in place, I've got that in place, I've learned this, I've done this, I've achieved this, I've got this bank balance. No, all creation starts with a blank page.
Yes.
So then what happens next? Well, it's a very technical phase I call mucking about. Right? You just start messing about with things. You try stuff. You see what happens. You know, you go, I don't know, let me scribble with this crayon. I don't know, let me take this photograph. I don't know, let me write these words. I don't know, let me talk to this person. Right? There's no real sense of this is going to work. It's just you're trying stuff to see what happens. You're getting yourself into the game. Then, at a certain point, it clarifies in your mind. Your mind clears. You start to see a direction of travel, and you do the work. No great art is created. No great things in life are created without doing the work. That's one thing that I have seen. Not everything is hard work, but everything takes some work. And if you enjoy the work, if you get, that's not a sign that it's not meant to be, that you're having to work at it. Well, then great. That's in some ways the easiest stage because it's like, well, okay, I can do the work. But then at some point, doing the work turns into finding the flow.
I like that.
At some point in doing the work becomes effortless. It stops feeling like work. You get so absorbed in the process that it's almost like it is happening through you instead of coming at you.
Mm-hmm.
And we love that stage, and we sort of mythologize that stage and think that's the only stage that matters. No, that's part of the creative process.
Right.
And then at a certain point, as you go back and forth between doing the work, finding the flow, doing the work, finding the flow, you have to declare completion. You have to decide you're done. You have to ship the product. You have to send the book off to the publisher. You have to put the picture in a gallery. You have to say, done. And then you see what happens when this little creation steps out of the world on its own 2 feet. And not all creations make it in the world, but some of them do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beauty of the process. And that process, I liken it sometimes to marriage. Right? Most people flirt before they go on a date. Right? You know, they might flirt online, they might flirt in a bar, but they'll flirt with somebody before they decide whether or not they're going to date them.
Right.
Well, that's mucking about. Like, people try to commit to these grandiose goals when they've never spent any time with them.
Flirting with the idea.
Be with the idea, to just sit with it for a while and see, do you like it more after you've sat with it for a while than before? You know, then going on dates, well, that's like mucking about, going on dates. You're checking it out. You're trying it out. You're hanging out together. You're doing stuff together. You're seeing, do I like this more now that I've gone on some dates with it than I did before I started? If not, well, I'm probably not going to keep going. If so, well, hey, maybe we can get engaged, right? Maybe we can commit to this now. Maybe we can throw ourselves in. We can do the work and find the flow and be about creating. And then if we love it, we get married to it. We do it. We make our lives about it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes what started out as an impossible project turns into a life calling.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't get married without engaging first. You don't get engaged without dating. You don't date without flirting. And yet we somehow think we're supposed to find our life mission without doing anything with our life first.
Right. And this metaphor that you're using is applied to the creative process or any project that ultimately will lead to a calling or lead to discovering our calling.
Absolutely. So yeah. I'm flirting with writing detective fiction right now. Mm-hmm. I've only ever written self-help. Mm-hmm. And I've been writing since 1990. And I love reading detective books. So I'm flirting with writing some detective fiction. I don't know if I'm ever going to do it properly. Mm-hmm. But I don't care because I'm enjoying flirting with it. I'm enjoying mucking about. I'm enjoying trying stuff. Now, that may turn into a novel one day. It may turn into a bunch of short stories. It may turn into nothing. But the very act of engaging with it makes it possible. It puts some meat on the bones. It puts some clothes on the invisible man. It becomes something I can see, something that becomes possible instead of some impossible dream that maybe one day.
Absolutely. We're listening to and talking with Brother Michael Neal. And right after this Sound of Rhythm and Joy, we're going to come back. We're going to explore what he talks about, a powerful metaphysical principle that we see our experience only. It's always coming from our own mind. And we're not at the mercy of the world. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about a lot of other things. We'll be right back.
How does it feel now that time is running out? How do you feel that it's slipping away? Hiding out in a life so frivolous. And even now, do you care what life is all about? If in the air is a sad song, to tell a prophet's blinking won't be long.
Song is called Teleprompter. It's track number 3 from the CD entitled The Love Project by Dr. Ricky Beebe. And that song was written by Dr. Ricky and her daughter Georgia. Free Your Mind. It's still time to maybe change the real, R-E-E-L, of this unreal movie. We have to free our mind first. It's called Teleprompter, one of my favorite songs, actually. I like that song. We're back with Brother Michael. Michael, I'm loving talking with you, man.
You too, my friend.
Now, you say that when we see that our experience is only and always coming from our own mind, we no longer experience ourselves at the mercy of the world. Now, this is a principle as well. Tell us what you mean by that and how particularly it relates to our creative process.
Well, I talk about it as the principle of thought, and that's thought with a capital T.
Yes.
So thought, as I'm talking about it, is a formless energy. It is the creative force. And we're all living in a world created by this creative force through our minds. And we experience it in consciousness. And I liken it a lot to a movie. The mind is the projector, and it projects the movie out onto the screen of consciousness. And then we experience the movie through our senses, and it's like it's really happening out there.
Right.
We kind of lose sight of the fact that it started as a movie in our mind. And the two things that I think make this real for people, R-E-A-L, real, are if you think about when you go to a movie, you've got some say over which movie you go to, but you're not up in the booth, right? When the movie's on, the movie's on. And if it looks real to you, it's going to impact you. And if it looks real scary, you'll get real scared. And if it looks real sad, you'll feel real sad. And if it looks really funny, you'll laugh. And if it looks really happy, you'll feel great. And we love movies. We pay to go to movies.
Right.
We don't go to the movie theater to look at the projector and remind ourselves that it's just a movie.
Right.
We go to the movie to get lost in the illusion. Well, I think part of why we come here on the planet is to get lost in the illusion. But if you understand how movies work, it doesn't ruin the illusion because it's such a great illusion.
Right.
But it makes it a little less scary. Like when my son was young, he was about, I don't know, 6 years old, 7 years old around the time that Jim Carrey's How the Grinch Stole Christmas came out.
Mm-hmm.
And when the previews for that movie came on, he would weep, he would scream, he would hide under the seat. Usually I had to take him out of the movie theater. And then a year later, he'd learned enough about movies that he could just watch the movie and laugh. Because he got that even though, he still got a little scared and he'd still get a little excited and he'd still laugh, he knew it wasn't real.
Right.
But when we see thought, when we see that our experience of life is an experience of thought in the moment, of this creative force taking form in the moment, then even if we do get a little scared, if we do get a little caught up, if we do get a little lost in the movie, there's a part of us that can enjoy the process. There's a part of us that knows this too shall pass because it's just a movie.
Right.
It's just thought, and real as it seems, there'll be another one on in a minute.
Absolutely.
That frees us up to create. That frees us up to not be dragged around by the nose, by our hopes and fears, and to keep our eye on what it is that we want to create beyond whatever movie happens to be playing inside us at the moment.
Absolutely. I often say that people don't experience reality. They experience their thoughts about reality. And they're having a direct experience.
I take it a step further, mm-hmm. and I would say they don't experience reality. They don't experience their thoughts about reality. They experience thought as reality.
That's absolutely true, because the thoughts are transmuting themselves into experience.
And thoughts become things.
Right.
The formless becomes form, and thought is the missing link between the two.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that you write along these lines, I think, is very powerful. You say, when faced with the choice between waiting for a creative solution to our personal or business challenges or trying to wring an answer out of our brain by worrying, it's amazing how often we choose to go with the limited thinking of our little brain over the awesome creative capacity of the universal mind, our innate health, wisdom, and resilience. It's like we default back to the little brain rather than release to our expanded nature.
And it's just a lack of faith in the creative capacity of the larger mind, and that lack of faith is just a lack of understanding. We don't see it, so we don't look to it. Or we see it in moments, but we think they're special. We think, well, that's only available to me when my kid is trapped under a car. That's only available to me when I'm down on my knees because my addiction's gotten out of control. That's only available to me when I'm in an extreme situation. Actually, that's available to us every moment.
Right.
We're just not used to looking there. I tell a story in the book about an invisible giant, and I ask people to imagine that they're walking with an invisible giant along a path, and they come across, the path is blocked on the mountain, and there's a huge boulder. And so our first thought is, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm empowered. And so we find a sort of use as a lever, and we kind of get it into a crack with the rock, and we're able to move it with all our strength just enough to kind of squeeze through, and we get to the other side of the rock, and we feel heroic. We feel, you know, if we're men, we feel like men. If we're women, we feel like men. We feel, you know, we feel triumphant, like we've done it. But actually, if you imagine yourself back facing the rock, recognizing the invisible giant who walks alongside you, who in fact is a part of you, well, the invisible giant can pick up that rock between two fingers and move it aside. Now, you won't feel like a hero. You won't feel like, oh, look at what I did. But you'll be further along the path than you were before, and you won't be exhausted, and you won't be scuffed at the knee, and you'll be as good as new.
Right, right. And so in your workshops, you assist people in aligning with that kind of thinking and that kind of feeling.
Well, and it's like you were saying earlier, we were talking about how truth is uncovered. It's what's already there. Insight is a glimpse of what has always been true. What happens is when somebody sees this for themselves, when they get insight into it, it's harder to forget, right? So it comes with them. There's nothing to practice. Once you know it's there, you just naturally are drawn to it more and more of the time because it's so powerful, but it's also beautiful.
Right.
Living in harmony with that, living from that deeper mind, that deeper self, the God within, the spirit within, whatever language you've got for it, it's such a gorgeous way to live that the fact that it also helps you create in the world is just kind of like a bonus. It's like frosting on the cake.
Absolutely. And of course, this all stems from being on an adventure and holding that space that we were talking about earlier. Now, what are the secrets? How do you define the secrets of effortless productivity? Some of these same principles are applying.
Well, they are. And see, I always thought insights would be like Charlton Heston, you know, in the Ten Commandments. Oh, my God! You know, and this big revelation. And I find most insights are like Homer Simpson. Oh! You just suddenly see something and feel like an idiot that you never noticed it before.
Right.
Well, when I talk with business people usually, but anyone really, about productivity, one of the things that nobody seems to notice until I point it out is that productivity isn't really about how much you're getting done. It's about the relationship between effort and reward.
Mm-hmm.
The less effort it takes to get a result, the more result you get for each effort, that's the measure of productivity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not one-to-one. We think it's one-to-one, so we think if I want to get more, I need to do more. And if I need to do more, well, there are time constraints, so I need time management tools. There are people restraints, so I need communication tools. And the harder I work, the better it goes. Well, if it was really one-to-one effort to reward, that would be true, but it isn't. And the easiest place for people to see it is diminishing returns.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We've all gotten to a place where we can tell we've been working too long, too hard, and like every effort brings negative five. You know, we're sitting for an hour staring at the computer screen, realizing we haven't typed anything for an hour, or, you know, we're going round and round in circles in a meeting and just nothing is coming of it.
Right.
Well, the same is true in reverse. There are a couple of simple things that when they're present, you get a lot more bang for your buck. You get a lot more juice to the squeeze.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one is engagement, absorption. The more we throw ourselves into something, the more this invisible giant comes through, the more this creative force can use us. And just all sorts of things occur that you just never would have thought of. And you start to notice possibilities and opportunities that just weren't there before you got into it.
Right.
And so when we're bought in, you know, some people use the word committed. I have a sort of a mixed relationship with that word. But the idea is right, that when we are all in, that's completely different from being mostly in. It's not a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
It's exponentially different. And then the other part of that is enjoyment. That when we're enjoying what we're doing, everything works better. Other people work better with us because they enjoy being around us. We work better because we're enjoying what we're doing. Putting in the hours doesn't sound like a punishment. It sounds like a reward. And suddenly we find that not only are we enjoying it more, but when we're fully engaged, when we're enjoying what we're doing, and we can enjoy anything. That's
yes.
Something I talk about in the book. But when we're fully engaged and enjoying what we're doing, we get exponential productivity. We get seemingly effortless productivity. We get so much more done in so much less time. And that's part of what makes the impossible possible.
Absolutely. I'm speaking, everyone, as we approach the last bit of our interview here, with the author of Inside Out Revolution and the Space Within. His next contribution will be coming out at the beginning of 2018, January 2nd, Creating the Impossible. a 90-day program to get your dreams out of your head and into the world. And we've been covering a lot of material in this period of time. Now, Michael, one of the things that I love is you caution people when they're dealing with their impossible project to watch out for premature practicality. I love that. Break that down for us.
Well, I've heard so many great reasons why not to do something over the years, just as a coach who works with high achievers. And people are amazing. Like, they can sometimes convince me it's a bad idea. But the reason it sounds like a bad idea is because they're talking about, yeah, but, you know, if I get really successful, then I'm going to wind up cheating on my wife and doing drugs, and I don't want to do that, so I'm not going to try to be successful. Which to me is like saying, I'm going to drive from New York to California, but I'm not going to do it because I'm scared of heights, and I might come across the Grand Canyon somewhere along the road, so I don't want to risk it. You'll deal with the Grand Canyon if and when you come to it. You'll deal with your baser impulses if and when they arise. You don't have to deal with them before they happen.
Right.
And if you see that, you're less sucked into your really rational reasons why there's no point.
Right. And that rational reasoning, it allows you to set up a case for failure and why it can't be done, rather than listing maybe just one reason why it can be done and placing your attention on that.
It's true. I mean, it's funny, but I almost think that we kind of engage in an unconscious game of why you can't blame me for not achieving this. Like, we lay out all the reasons why we're going to fail up front, just to kind of, it's like two guys meeting for the first time over golf and both talking about how bad they are,
right,
so that if they have a great round, they feel good, but if they have a bad round, it's okay.
Yeah, right. They already set themselves up for failing.
I mean, I told you it was,
I told you I was no good.
You know, neck's a little stiff. I mean, this driver's like 13 years old.
And,
right. Well, we do the same thing. It's like, well, you know, it's a really difficult time in the industry. You know, I lived in England for a long time, and there was a cartoon for actors called Hamlet, about a pig who was an actor. And one of my absolute favorite strips, Hamlet goes into his agent's office, and he's mad at his agent. He's like, why aren't I getting auditions? And the agent goes, well, it's really slow at the moment. And Hamlet says, oh, don't give me that. Bob's going out, and he's getting work, and Cindy's going out, and she's getting work. And the agent says to him, well, nobody really likes you, and you're not that good an actor. And there's a pause, and then Hamlet says, so it's really slow at the moment?
He won't take the feedback.
And that does. We look for the excuse that makes us feel better about ourselves. But it doesn't matter whether the excuse makes you feel better about yourself or not. It still stops you from moving forward.
Absolutely.
And the one guarantee in life is if you don't move forward, you're not going to get anywhere.
So we want to be careful not to become master of excuses. And we become a master of being an explorer, an adventurer. And understanding that all of this is being projected from our mind, so we have the possibility to change all of that.
And seeing the innocence in it. Like, we don't think of them as excuses. We think of them as excellent explanations for why we aren't where we want to be in our lives and why we haven't created what we want to create.
Right.
Not seeing that it's the plausibility of our explanation that stops us from creating in the first place.
Absolutely. Now, help people come to an understanding of how they get an idea about what they're possible project will be. You have five guidelines.
Well, you know, probably the moment when people realize their impossible project, from what I've seen over the years, you know, I describe it as it makes them gasp, grin, and giggle.
Gasp, grin, and giggle. The three G's.
The three G's. You know, there's just a sense where they go, oh my God, that? Oh, I couldn't do that. No, come on. Shit. And that's it. Like, that's how you know. It's ridiculous, but it's exciting ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It's, well, there's no point. So I tell them, here are the five rules. You've got to believe you've got less than a 20% chance of success through hard work.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you think you could get there if you just work hard enough, that's not an impossible project. That's just a difficult one.
Right.
So we don't want people to work hard. We want them to tap into this invisible giant. We want them to find this deeper creative self.
Absolutely.
You've got to be sufficiently, this is the second one, you've got to be sufficiently inspired about what you want to create that you're going to be glad you invested time in it, even if it doesn't work out.
Right.
Right? Because it probably won't. It's an impossible project. So sometimes people take things on that are a means to an end. Well, it's only worth it if I get here. I remember working with a woman once, and I thought she had a lot of potential as a coach. And I told her, I thought I was complimenting her. I said, you know, in a couple of years, I think you could be really successful at this. And she looked at me in horror and said, a couple of years? I may as well get a job in a supermarket. I thought, okay. Because it's like, if it's not worth it, then don't do it. I mean,
right.
That's fine. So the first thing, you got to really kind of not believe you can do it through hard work. The second is, you got to be inspired about it. The third is, and this is an important one, it's got to be about creating a result, not a feeling. Sometimes say, oh, my impossible project is to be happy. My impossible project is to do something because it'll make me really proud of myself. My impossible project will show people that I really am. It'll prove to myself something about me or something my parents thought about me isn't true. That's not creating.
Right.
The realm of feeling is an inner game. Finding a deeper feeling, finding your happiness, finding meaning, that's a mining operation. That's an excavation operation, not a manufacturing one, not a creative one. Creating results in the world, that's about creating. And that kind of leads to the fourth one, which is that it's not about you. Mm-hmm. Creating is not about you. Mm-hmm. And that's a beautiful thing, right? Van Gogh was not, by all accounts, a very happy man, but he created some beautiful paintings.
Yes.
And I'm not suggesting be unhappy. I'm saying whether you're happy or unhappy, whether you feel good about yourself or you feel worthless, you can create. It's an egalitarian craft.
Right.
We all have the capacity.
Right.
We both live in Hollywood. So we know plenty of people with low self-esteem who create all sorts of cool things in the world.
Absolutely.
And then the final one, just the fifth one that I always tell people is, choose one thing, not 12. It's really tempting to go, oh, but I want to create this, and I want to create this, and I want to create this. And you can. But when you're learning, it's a lot easier to learn on one thing. And then what you learn, the insights you have, how you've transformed on your adventure, will make the other 11 things much easier to create going forward.
Absolutely. Because the attitude has shifted. Habits have developed. Your perspective has changed.
Right. Which the way that we see it, we don't see it as our perspective has changed. The world just doesn't look so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't notice it necessarily as, oh, I've changed. It looks like the world's changed.
It looks like that, right.
But that's just because we're living in a world of thought.
Right. So this brings us then to the distinction between goals and miracles.
Which I think is kind of just a fun thing to notice, is if we think it's within our control, we call it a goal.
Mm-hmm.
If we think it's outside our control, we pray for a miracle. So in a way, how miraculous something appears is inversely proportional to how much we think we're the cause of its creation.
Right.
But miracles are really common. They're really ordinary. They happen all the time. But we kind of blind ourselves to them. There's that beautiful thing Einstein said where, you know, in this life, you either have to live as if nothing is a miracle or as if everything is a miracle.
Right.
And when you start to see that everything is a miracle, it's not by our will. It's by something beyond us. Well, then relying on miracles doesn't sound like a bad idea. It sounds like a practical strategy.
Which is a principle. Which becomes a principle.
It's 100% reliable, even if how it turns up is 98% unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's going to be a miracle. I just don't know where and when.
Right. But I'm going to be available to it. I'm preparing myself.
I'm moving forward, counting on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I can keep moving, even when I don't see how I'm going to get there.
Right. I know exactly that dynamic. Now, you also teach learning to fail. In week 4 of your Creating the Impossible program, we discussed that we tend to make a big deal out of things not working. Why is this so, and what do you mean by learning to fail?
The most obvious example, and you know, anyone who's had a kid or was a kid, right, which pretty much is all of us, right, you know that you failed a lot when you were learning how to walk.
Right.
You were terrible at it. Like, if your parents or you took failure seriously, you wouldn't be walking now. You would have given up the 48th time you fell over.
Right.
But kids don't think in terms of failure and success. They think in terms of where they want to get. Right? They don't learn to walk so that they can learn to walk. They learn to walk because they want to get somewhere, and walking just looks efficient.
Right.
And yet, somewhere along the way, we've learned to fail. We've learned to think of the inevitable trial and error, trial and success of experimentation and learning as success or failure. And that failure is bad and success is good. You know, there's an old Mark Twain quote I share in the book. If people learn to walk and talk the way we teach them to read and write, everyone would limp and stutter. Right? We're natural born learners. So yes, when you take on something new, there'll be a learning curve, but that's easy. It's when we think we've got to learn by, okay, I am going to do this now. Oh, that did not work. Oh, sad. Okay, let me try. And we break it down into something where we get really discouraged because we become more and more self-conscious. It starts to feel more and more like it's about us. And it's not about us. It's, I think, probably the greatest thing I've learned for myself in doing this work with others and with clients is I used to get incredibly discouraged if things didn't work out, and without meaning it to, it shrunk my world.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was less and less willing to try things that I didn't know were going to work, because I was kind of had post-traumatic failure disorder.
Right.
Well, when I started to see that that sense of discouragement, that feeling like a failure, was made of thought, and as such it came and went like clouds, I didn't have to take it into account in the same way, and I noticed I bounced back quicker. I might still get discouraged, but it didn't knock me out of the game. And what I found is, and this is something everybody who's achieved anything in the world knows, is you got to put in the hours.
Yes.
And if you're going to stop because something didn't work out, you're never going to find out what only can be seen when you put in the hours.
Absolutely. And in week 10, you do talk about becoming discouragement proof.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe one of the biggest lessons. I think it's the biggest gift I got from doing this work. But I know a lot of clients talk about how that one thing, I don't think I tell the story in the book, but I was talking with a guy who ran a company who taught this process to his sales team. And it was during the last recession. And at one point, one of the guys in the sales team said, man, if this recession goes on for 6 more months, we're going to own the industry. Because they were discouragement proof.
Right.
They knew, look, it's trial and error, trial and success. That's how everything works, and we'll get better with every call we make. And the more calls we make, the more we're in the game, the more we're engaged, the more we're enjoying it, the better it's going to go. And they were cleaning up while everybody else was trying to motivate themselves to get back in the game, get back on the horse. You can do it sooner or later.
Right.
These guys were having a ball.
Right. That recession revealed resourcefulness.
Nice.
Yeah.
I like it.
Now, will you be doing an impossible program in 2018?
We will indeed. Yeah, we're going to begin the next one a few weeks after the book comes out. We do one every January. It's my favorite thing to do. And so this one's going to start something like the 16th of Jan or 18th of Jan, somewhere in there.
Outstanding. How can people get in touch with you, Michael?
Well, michaelneal.org. We have the Caffeine for the Soul newsletters and blogs and podcasts there, and we announce every training.
Outstanding. This has been great. We've been speaking with Michael Neal, and that's N-E-I-L-L. So when you go to michaelneal.com, that's how you spell it.
.org.com is an insurance guy in Georgia. Nice guy I've talked to.
Well, Michael Neal's going to give you assurance, not insurance.
Ooh.
That's .org.
You should do this for a living, Michael. You're very good at it.
Michael, it's been great being with you, man. This has been really, really cool. Thank you.
A pleasure, my friend.
Thank you for showing up. And I'm glad that you all showed up to listen. It's been wonderful, all of you around the world. If you want to know what's going on at Agape International, go to agapelive.com, agapelive.com. And be aware that we're having a great conference in 2018, April the 27th through the 29th. It's going to be at Agape Center itself. Joe Dispenza is going to be one of the beings with us. It's going to be some very powerful people. And many of you are starting to show up for my Way of Meditation service every Sunday at 6:30 a.m. as a prelude to the other two services. And that's really good because meditation is a way by which you learn to pay undistractable attention to reality. So I'm looking forward to seeing you at Agape on a Wednesday evening or a Sunday morning. If you don't live in L.A., of course, you can live stream us. You can do the Facebook Live, and it's better in community. Have a powerful and magnificent day, because you know what? You are powerful, and you are magnificent. Peace and blessings.